You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
This is just a song to say that I'm proud for what they are. And I hope my world can take me half that far.
Folks, up next, Grammy and Juno Award-winning singer-songwriter Dan Hill. And this is one of his songs, McCarthy's Day. Pretty much talks about his parents. Have a listen.
Rebellious lovers. They left behind a nation far too proud and powerful to say that love, oh, love transcends all colors. And some black men turned against my father. Some white men turned against my mother. Each race has its place, they all would say. And with a past so battle worn and a future begging to be born, I found the light that's growing still today.
Well, after more than 30 years in the business, Dan Hill has more often than not been behind the curtain, allowing other chart-topping artists to sing his stirring ballads and pop hits, such as Celine Dion, Britney Spears, Tina Turner, Rod Stewart, 98 Degrees, The Backstreet Boys, George Benson, Reba McEntire, and Alan Jackson, just to name a few. Between Dan's own hit singles, platinum albums, 5 Junos, a Grammy, and countless ASCAP awards for most played songs over 3 decades, he has amassed over 100 million combined unit sales for his incredible collection of songs. And folks, Dan Hill is back with his first album featuring new material since 96, entitled Intimate. And it is probably one of the classiest albums I have heard in quite a long time. I think maybe, Tim, since I hooked into James Taylor's October Road.
Right.
Love both of these CDs back to back. He's also penned the best-selling book, I Am My Father's Son, a memoir of love and forgiveness, which traces his difficult and poignant relationship with his father. And, of course, the book came on the heels of a compelling cover story in Maclean's magazine, where Dan wrote about how his family was nearly destroyed by his son's involvement in Toronto's thug culture. DanHill.com is the website, and Dan Hill is on the phone. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thank you for joining us. What's it like being married to Faith Hill? Boy, that's just got to be... Have you ever had anybody start an interview like that where they really thought you were married because his...
Yes, I have, actually. The funny thing is that, because she was married to a music publisher named Daniel Hill.
Yeah, Daniel Hill, yeah.
And People Magazine printed this, and but they always would confuse it and say, married to songwriter Dan Hill. And people that have known all my life, because I've always lived in Toronto, say, what was it like being married to Faith Hill? I said, I've never even met her. They said, well, that's not true. People Magazine said, because People Magazine... And I just thought it was... I didn't really care, you know, whatever. But then she went public with one album, said that her ex-husband, Daniel Hill, used to beat her up.
Oh.
And all these radio stations stopped playing my songs. Okay. They said, you're a hypocrite. You're writing all these types of songs and your wife beat her. That's when I got mad.
Oh, my goodness.
And she had to do a press conference saying that she was never married to me and that I'd never beat her up. True story.
Wow. I had no idea the backstory in that. I was just trying to be cheeky. Well, listen, instead of talking about Faith, let's talk about Beverly. How long has that marriage been going on?
28 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Well, that was one of the great things that came out of my family. My parents were, you know, it was an unbelievable love story. And the greatest gift they gave me beyond my parents' accomplishments was unconditional love.
Yeah.
They were always there for each other, no matter what was going on. And, you know, that was something I'll always treasure.
Well, here's the backstory as far as I'm concerned. My wife's name is Bev, and we had broken up. She had dumped me, you know, because I was a jerk. And I talked her into going to a Dan Hill concert at the Forum.
Wow.
And we went to the Dan Hill. I hitchhiked from the cottage down to where my car was and got the car, picked her up, went to the Dan Hill concert, and then we ended up getting married. So I pretty much give you all the credit for my marriage. Thank you, Dan.
Well, what can I say? I'm more than honored.
However, I was creeped out by some of your fans who were sitting in the front row clutching on to Dan Hill albums and sort of swaying to the music, and they were absolutely swooning over you.
Yeah, well, it's safe to say that that doesn't happen anymore.
No, okay.
My fans have grown up with me, so they're, you know, I'm 56, so you don't get a lot of swooning and swaying anymore.
No. The other memory I have, and my apologies for starting off like this, but dude, you're not the best dancer I've ever seen.
Who, me?
Yeah.
That's a good, you know, I thought it was my role as a black man to puncture all the stereotypes about black people. So it was my role to go out and let people know that I'm black, but I have no rhythm.
Oh, I thought it was because the Forum stage was rotating and it kept you off balance, maybe, a little bit. But
no, it's kind of like why my brother and I refused to eat watermelon.
Right.
No, I'm serious. I'm saying I'm a black man and I have no rhythm, so let's puncture all the stereotypes.
Oh, you kill me. Look at me and you'll see exactly what can happen to any nerd when success comes calling. That's a quote from you. Well said, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Listening to your latest CD, I just realized how much you and Bruce Coburn have such similar inflections in the way you sing, especially the way you come off your R's. Unbelievably similar.
Well, also, there is a Canadian way of saying R's, and you'll notice with most Canadian singers that they sing R's entirely different than American singers.
Maybe a lot more harsh? Is that maybe a...
Well, the R's are longer and,
right,
and more rolling. And, you know, listen to Rise Up, Rise Up.
Right.
You know, listen to the way Lorraine Segato draws out the R's. You'll never hear Springsteen draw out an R like that.
Right, right. You and Bruce, are you tight? Do you hang?
Well, I spent some time with him in Stockholm, actually.
Okay.
So he's actually a really, really, really nice guy.
I had an interview with him a few years back and thoroughly enjoyed it. One of the highlights for me, of course.
Yeah, I've found, interestingly enough, that the people that are the most talented are usually the ones that have the least attitude.
Yeah, well said again. Does Gordon Lightfoot fall into that category now,
yes,
now that he's stopped drinking?
Yeah, he's absolutely one of the sweetest, warmest guys I've ever met. Incredibly generous. As I say in my book, he lent me his Learjet for $5,000 he said, I'll give you my Learjet for the night, Dan, but I got to tell you, there's no woman in the world worth $5,000.
Back to Faith Hill again. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you'll never be a Bruce Coburn. Were those words as caustic as one would imagine, said by your father?
Yeah, they worship, and still do, by the way, Bruce Coburn. I actually, when I was a kid growing up, there were social conveners, and as social conveners of our high school, we were in charge of getting musicians to play at our school. Back then, there were pretty big budgets, unlike now. And so I actually brought Bruce Coburn to my school to perform and paid him out of the school budget. I idolized them, you know. And so for my dad to say, you'll be no Bruce Coburn, he was hitting me where he knew it would hurt the most.
Wow. Daniel Grafton Hill III, of course, was the founding director of the Canadian Human Rights Commission and co-founded the Ontario Black History Society. He was an Ontario ombudsman, activist, author, academic. Anything else you want me to put in there?
I like to say that one of the salient features of my father, beyond all the great professional things he did, well, beyond being probably by far the best storyteller of all Hills, I mean, was that he was so, in his own way, incredibly devoted and loyal to his family. He would always, you know, he was tough on me and tough on my brother. And I always like to say that because he was so tough on us and we had to fight him tooth and nail through our adolescence, we were then prepared to take on the music business and, in my brother's case, the book business.
Yeah.
But he was, on the other hand, when the chips were down, he was always there.
You know, the bottom line behind the theme of your book, I think, is that you had a high-achieving black father who, according to him, had an underachieving son.
Yeah.
And how you lived didn't really jive with what he was all about.
Well, the great irony was we were very similar. I was as driven as he was, but I knew unconsciously my gifts lay in non-academic fields. I was always almost plunking out of every class.
Right.
I was a slow learner, and they couldn't understand why I could write so well. Yet I couldn't comprehend. You know, how could I write these essays that were always the best essays, but I could never understand what they were saying in books? And so I knew intuitively that my real talent was music and words. And so I knew from when I was like six that this is what I was going to do. And so he didn't understand that and thought I was going to be, you know, a welfare child.
Well, of course, in 2003, your father passes after a brutal battle with diabetes. Did you say what needed to be said before he passed?
Yes, I did. And I actually wrote a song, which is on my intimate CD, called I Am My Father's Son. I played that to my father just before he died, you know. And there's a scene in my book where I go up to him and I say, why? Why did you do these things? Why did you say I was no Bruce Coburn? Why did you tell me to be aware of my limitations? And he said, well, I was trying to protect you from the world, you know. The world's a mean place, and your head was in the clouds. And then he said, and when I grew up, these kind of things never happened to kids. You know, the Beatles came out, and they changed the world for my generation. But, you know, and my dad, to his great credit, said he hadn't understood how the world had changed, you know. So that, for my father, was an unbelievable concession. And then at the end of what he said, he's in his wheelchair, you know, he says, I underestimated you, son. And I started to cry, because
wow,
that's all I wanted him to say, was that he underestimated me.
What was it, Dan, that paralyzed your songwriting abilities after your father's death?
Well, what happened was, usually whenever anything is emotional or traumatic that happens to me, I always go to songwriting to heal the wounds. And for the first time after my dad died, I couldn't write. And then it hit me that I was always writing songs not to have hits, not to make money, not to get Celine Dion covers, but to get my dad's attention,
right,
to get his approval. And now that he was no longer with us, I felt that I had lost my muse, meaning my father's, you know, attention. So
yeah,
I couldn't write. So then I said, I better do something or I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. Because, you know, term, idle hands are the workshop of the devil.
Right.
So that's when I dove into the book. Because I knew I had to do something with all this pain. And that also made my father seem alive again, because luckily he donated all his letters to the National and Provincial Archives. And it was letters that I saw the real man behind the father.
Right.
And that the letters actually were a big part of driving the book.
Are you standing in the middle of a freeway?
I'm sorry, it's too loud. I'm just outside a cafe. But I can move. I can go inside. I was afraid to go inside.
Well, no, I was just, you know, you're worried about going inside because I think you think the phone will drop, right? The reception?
It probably will. Tell me, is this better?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, can you hear me better?
Can you hear me now? Yeah, actually, yeah. I can. No, that's good. That's
okay.
Good. Just keep your hand out the window. That's all we need.
Okay, how's this?
That's good. Brilliant.
Okay.
Would you, Dan, have written this book had your father still been alive? Probably
never.
Not, right?
No way.
No.
There's not a chance. I mean, my brother wrote a great book called Blackberry Sweet Juice that deals to some degree with my family, but there are certain things he just couldn't say because my dad was still alive.
So what did his death allow you to write about that you really just couldn't have done had he still been alive and able to read the book himself?
Well, actually, the biggest thing was I didn't read the 700 letters he'd written from the age of 6 to 76 until after he died.
Oh, wow.
Which were, again, in the National and Provincial Archives. So upon reading his letters, I saw the vulnerable kid, and I realized that he was just like me, fearing that he wasn't going to live up to his father's expectations, and that more than anything else, he needed his dad's approval. And that was an incredibly profound discovery for me, and it made me realize that this is the issue with fathers and sons always, right across the board, right across time, right across cultures, you know, is the need to feel that you can somehow stand up to your family name. And so I realized that what I'd stumbled upon was really not my story, but a universal family story.
When I was doing the research on you, I thought, there's no way we're going to get through this interview as quickly as need be, because there are so many questions, so many areas of your life, facets of your life, that I think are fascinating to so many people on so many levels. But folks, Dan Hill has joined us for our Father's Day special. And I guess, when I think about your father's death, you have said that it left a hole in your heart.
Yes.
How do you describe that hole in your heart? Can you put words to that, or is it an indescribable thing?
Well, this is this deep chasm, this huge black void. You know, I dream about him still every night.
Wow.
This is what I do say to myself and to other people, that he's still there. He's in me. His genes, and this isn't like new age nonsense. I mean, genetically speaking, he is in me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I watch my son. I watch the way he uses words. You know, I watch his quick way with a put-down, for example, and I see my father going, oh, my God, that's my dad, you know. And so that's the comfort, the spirituality, if you will, that I take from this.
Yeah.
Is he is alive. He is alive in me. He's alive in my brother. I see some of the things my brother does, and I go, my God, that's my father. You know? And there's a real comfort in that, and I'd like to say that hopefully we all find comfort in this, because this is, as Martin Amis wrote in his book Experience, life is a series of unavoidable miracles and tragedies. And how do we deal with the unavoidable losses that we all are confronted with? This is just a part of life. And how I deal with it is, A, through creativity, as does my brother, and B, through knowing that there is a part of my father in me. That's a scientific fact.
How did it go singing Daddy's song at the memorial service? Were you able to kind of keep it together?
I teared up, and my voice quavered. And as I said in my book, when I was a little kid, always being the singer to sing for all the parent-teacher events, my teacher would always tell me when I was 7 or 8, look up at the basketball net, then you won't lose it. And so, you know, I was looking at my dad's sisters and my cousins and my mother and my brother, and the only thing I could do was look up at the imaginary basketball net in the church as I sang Daddy's song.
A man has as many selves as he does situations. That's a famous quote from your father. A man has as many selves as he does situations. What selves, Dan, did you get from your dad?
Well, the incredibly ambitious, driven
right.
self. The ability with words and the ability to tell stories. My dad would take us across the country in his Valiant station wagon. The three of us would be in the back seat. My mom would be in the passenger seat. And he would make up stories extemporaneously for the 3,000-mile trip, just off the top of his head. And he never stopped, just to keep us engaged. And he had us enthralled for, like, 10 days. And so that storytelling ability was something that was passed on, you know, to all of us.
Are there any selves you got from your dad that you really wish you hadn't?
Absolutely. I can have a real temper, have way too much pride. When Donny Osmond went on the radio and said to me that he, you know, not knowing he was talking to me, that he sang Sometimes When He Touched Better Than I Did. You know, I lost my temper, and I shouldn't have. I'm a little bit too judgmental, and I'm a little bit too stubborn. You know, there's something that psychologists call contingent self-esteem, whereas you only feel good about yourself if you're achieving, you know.
Right.
And there's that... My dad had that issue, you know. Some hyperachievers often feel when they fall out of the spotlight, they fall into a depression because they feel this imposter syndrome that whatever they did didn't count because it was in the past. And so I have a bit of that. I have to kind of learn to, you know, embrace myself and not just based on whether I'm achieving or not.
My 21-year-old son is going to join us later in the show, of course, our Father's Day special. He's the oldest. But it reminds me of just how hard, and he often reminds me of just how hard we were on him because he was the oldest as compared to his younger sister. Was that the same with your father?
He was the hardest on me.
Yeah.
Because I was not a good student and I was not going to pursue higher education.
But because you were the oldest as well, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, he was always easier on females. He was very protective of females.
Right.
Because so many of the females in my dad's side of the family were mentally ill. So he had to take care of them.
Oh, yeah, like your uncle, who he thought, wasn't he an artist or a singer-songwriter or something? He thought you were going to turn out like him.
Well, he was afraid I was going to be gay. You know, he thought for anyone to be that sensitive and to write songs and to be a poet and to sing, you had to be gay. This is a big fear in Don Mills in the 60s.
Yeah.
The scourge of homosexuality. The irony is I didn't even know what it was.
No.
This is Don Mills in the 60s. I didn't know anything about that stuff. I'm going, what the hell? What is homosexual?
Wow.
This was, you know, that was the funny thing with my dad. He just thought anyone that was creative had to be gay.
You know, interestingly enough, I have a sister named Karen, and I was sort of the black sheep of the family, a high school dropout. How have Larry and Karen felt about your book? Did he treat them any differently?
Well, my brother, well, yes, he treated all of us differently. He was very hard on my brother as well. You know, he was not hard on my sister.
No.
Because she was the youngest and she was a girl, and he had a, you know, this sort of sweetness towards females that was just beautiful. My brother stood behind me all the way on my book, and my sister wasn't too happy about my book. My mother said, Dan, I love you. I hate your book.
Okay.
So that's the honest answer, and my answer to my mom is, you know what, Mom? Everybody sees families differently within the family. You weren't there with 90% of the stuff that went down between my dad and me.
Yeah.
I'm allowed to write what I want to write, and we're allowed to agree to disagree, and I love you. You know, part of being a family is you're going to have disagreements, and we're going to get angry at each other, but I will always love you despite the disagreement.
Dan, can you share with us a story of how you caught the master of the put-down dropping your name in a proud way? I think that's a classic story.
Well, Well, you know, he would always, to my face, always, you know, the joke was I would say, hey, I'm nominated for a Grammy. He'd say, as a writer? And I said, no, as a singer. And then he'd ball me out for not being nominated as a writer, and I'd feel like a loser. You know, so that being an example of, you know, the typical father's son, no matter what you do, it's not good enough. You know, you sell $5 million, well, why didn't you sell $10
million? Right, right.
So, but then behind my back, he was always really nice. So I phoned him. We were going out to dinner, and I phoned pretending to be the maitre d'. And I said, I'm just confirming the reservations, Dr. Hill. He said, yes, Dan Hill and my son, the famous folk singer, Dan Hill. And so then I busted him because I caught him being proud of me.
Classic. I just think I can see that moment so poignantly.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing, Dan, is that even though you write about your father's many idiosyncrasies, his incessant, you know, parental jabs, and some would say over-parenting, some would even say abusive, mm-hmm. you always come to his defense.
Well, what I tried to show was, you know, that we all have so many different sides. Again, that saying of a man has many selves or he has situations. He was a very complicated person, you know, a flawed yet inspiring, you know, dynamic yet overly domineering. And I just wanted to show as best as I could, the full human being, you know, because we're all complicated, and we all, as Walt Whitman said, I contradict myself. I am at large. I contain multitudes.
Right.
You know, so, you know, that's the nature. How boring if we were all had just one salient characteristic and nothing else.
The term abusive or abuse gets thrown around a lot these days. Are you comfortable hanging that label on your father or not?
I'm not comfortable saying that. I don't think I wouldn't call him abusive, no. Bullying, yes, absolutely. He was one hell of a bully.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say abusive, no.
He would always be there for you, much the same way his parents were for him.
Yeah, like when I was 25, I'd made and lost my first million. I was broke again. I was a has-been. You know, I'd lost my record deal. I'd lost everything. I was being sued for millions. He was right there. You know, as I say in my book, he went right down with my mom, looked at all the savings he'd saved up, you know, and said, whatever you need, son, we'll help you.
Have a listen to this clip. I just found this online, and we'll talk about it afterwards.
One of the reasons we founded the Ontario Black History Society is because black children from the islands, from the United States, from Africa, feel there and have been told there is no heritage here. And they'll relate to it because they'll know that their black ancestors who came from Africa and who came to Canada and to the United States did indeed contribute to the life of the community and to building of this country.
That, of course, was your father. When you hear that, does it conjure up things? Is it just, oh, yeah, yeah, that was my dad? Or is there still a lot of stuff there, Dan?
Well, the interesting thing is that I have literally become my father's son because in today's National Post, on page 3, is an article that I've written about some of the great things that black men in this country, Canada, have achieved.
Right.
So that's the funny thing is here I am pretending to be the opposite of my dad, the pop singer, if you will. And I've published at least 5 articles in the last year about black history, about some of the great things black men and women in our country have achieved.
Do you think you'll ever stop trying to win your father's approval, affection, love?
I don't think so. No, I think that will always be a driving part of me.
See, I have this theory about overachievers. I think they're all still trying to win the approval or love of a parent, which is why my kids will never become rich or famous. my kids know full on, full well, no matter what they do, it is very clear in our house. I love them. I approve of them. I appreciate them. I'm proud of them. But do you think there's any merit to that theory about overachievers?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I it's a double-edged sword for sure. You know, my brother and I really shouldn't drag my brother into this. Are extremely driven, and we feel as if nothing we've ever done in the past counts. And which is part of what makes us continue to create stuff, you know, is that we don't sit around and think, oh my God, look what we've got. We have no sense of that, you know.
Yeah,
it's just like, okay, what are we doing right now, right this instant? I got to write this song. I got to write this article, you know. I got to write this book. And whatever happened yesterday doesn't count. And so I don't think that's necessarily a good way to live. That being said, I do run 10 miles a day, and that helps calm me down a bit.
Oh, my goodness. By the time you were 5, you knew you had a good singing voice? Are you kidding me? I mean, maybe that's just because no one else could sing in Newmarket at the time.
That's good. Well, I think the one thing about my dad was that he did make us feel that we had to be confident. you know. Now, given that that was propaganda, but we've swallowed it because we always swallow our parents' propaganda.
Sure.
So I did not lack confidence in the things that I knew I was good at.
But what kind of a kid has a, quote, ferocious songwriting discipline between the ages of 14 and 22?
Well, there are actually a lot of great songwriters. A lot of great songs are written by teenagers. Remember, O'Donnell was written by that 15-year-old who died in that plane crash. Let me see now. Up, Up, and Away was written by Jimmy Webb when he was 17. Can't Find My Way Home was written probably by Stevie Winwood when he was 16. Fire and Rain and Something in the Way She Moves was written by James Taylor probably when he was 19.
All right.
Sorry.
All right. I get it.
That's the great thing about songwriting is so much of it is passion and emotion. So. Whereas writing novels, you do have to have more knowledge, I believe.
I find it rather ironic that it took almost a decade for one of your songs to crack the charts after Let This Song Last Forever. I just think that's ironic.
Yes. Yeah, it was... the thing is that having a huge hit is a life-altering experience, especially if you're the artist as well as the writer, you know. And it turns your life so inside out and upside down that sometimes it takes away what made you incredibly creative in the first place, which is the ability to be anonymous, to kind of silently, invisibly slip into a room, into a party, and to watch and observe. Suddenly you're not anonymous anymore, and that can really get in the way of your creativity.
Of course, the song that did follow up finally from Let This Song Last Forever was Can't We Try Just a Little Bit Harder? Again, irony.
Yes. Well, like I said, Tina Turner scolded me one night as I was saying my book and saying, man, that Sometimes When I Touch is an amazing song. I recorded it right after I broke up with Ike. Now, how come you haven't written anything else as good? So I walked out of the dressing room feeling like I was an underachieving creative writing student, and Tina, who was like my dad, like, you know,
yeah,
saying, hey, as a, you know, this is the silent truth about a lot of blacks from certain socioeconomic classes, that we're all kind of crazy overachievers. And so, you know, based on Tina Turner saying I got to get it together, you know, because then I said, I'm going to write another hit, and then I wrote Can't We Try.
I want a little honesty here from Dan Hill. Wasn't it the chicks that screwed up your career? Seriously.
Well, yes. Yeah. it was me that screwed up my career. But it's definitely true that when you're 23 years of age and you're touring across the world with, as my dad quoted, the sexiest all get-out song, you know, a lot of time is spent chasing women, which really would have been better spent writing songs.
Right.
And the great thing about being married for 28 years is the cliche is once you get married, you settle down, you stop writing. But what happened with me is I settled down, and that's when I really started writing.
Unbelievable. The other thing, and we're just about at the end of our time here, but what was it like for a guy who, when he was a kid, delivering the Don Mills Mirror, wouldn't even cross people's lawn, to all of a sudden have a kid who was drawn to trouble?
Well, I think we often try to be the opposite of our parents. This is the interesting thing, is my dad, as I found out through writing this book, liked trouble. He got in a lot of trouble. You know, like, as I say in my book, he ran around with a group called the Red Wine Boys when he was 17, doing nothing but getting drunk and chasing women to the point where he got fired from his job and drafted into the Army. I was the opposite of my dad, meaning that even though I was a musician, the irony was because I was a musician, I was never in trouble because I was always in my room writing songs. My son, on the other hand, is exactly like my dad. He had a nose for mischief and a nose for trouble. And very often, the case is that kids of so-called celebrity parents have a very hard time adjusting. Because the celebrities are usually out being a celebrity, meaning they're not around. And then the kid has to live under the shadow of the star, and, you know, very often some dangerous things happen. And so in my son's case, due to lack of me being around and his trying to find his racial identity and feeling rejected in a WASP community, he sought out a bunch of kids that ended up being related to gangs, and a lot of these kids were into stuff such as murder.
Such as murder?
Well, I don't want to sugarcoat it. These gangs are killing people.
Wow. That's probably one of the most poignant IEs I've ever heard.
Well, you know, I do believe in openness, you know.
Yeah.
I do believe that the honesty is not too much, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise that he was involved with some kids that were dealing in drugs and dealing in pimping, and in killing people.
So, okay.
They all got killed themselves, and I wrote about it, and I write about it again in the National Post today. You know?
Yeah. How did Grandpa's death affect your son?
He was devastated. He was devastated. My dad always said to my son, "You're a genius, boy. You're just like your father, and you're just like me. You're a troublemaker, you're wild, but you're a genius, and I know you're going to do great things." And that kind of buoyed up my son, but it also made him terribly, terribly bereft when my granddad died. He felt that my granddad got him like no one else did.
So was your son into the trouble before your dad's passing?
No, after.
So what did it play a role? Was it a catalyst in him, going off the deep end or whatever?
Well, I think there are, like so many things, there are a lot of reasons why he embraced what I'll call the thug culture.
Sure.
You know, that was one of many. That was one of many.
All right. Well, listen, your grandfather, I think if I've got this right, because the genealogy of your family is incredible. I spent a fair amount of time fascinated reading about your family. Not even you. I mean, I like you, but I was fascinated with your family. Was it your grandfather or great-grandfather that was the dean of theology at Howard?
My grandfather was the dean of theology at Howard and would bring luminaries such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to speak at his school.
Okay,
and they would have a long-standing correspondence.
You have quite a spiritual pedigree as well.
Absolutely. He had a PhD in theology. I mean, I was there. I was in the churches watching him minister. It was incredible.
So where has all that landed? I mean, you know, you're on the God Show here. We're going to ask you that question. Have you landed on a monotheistic belief, or are you sort of pluralistic, sort of Baha'i? I mean, where are you at, Dan?
I believe in humanity. I believe, despite the obvious horrors and atrocities that go on in the world, in the unconditional acts of human kindness. I am a humanist. I have huge, huge, powerful belief in the good in people and in the power of change for the better. You know, I do not put a religious, I do not affix a religious affiliation to that belief. However, the things that I believe in usually or invariably are right there with so many faiths, including the Christian faith. I believe that it's what's really important is what you do as opposed to what you say, because so many people say one thing and do the other.
Right. So as long as you're not hypocritical, believe what you want. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, I wouldn't say believe what you want. If you believe in white supremacy, I would do my best to disabuse one of that notion.
Right.
But I'm saying that it's really, really tricky sometimes to ascribe to a particular set of beliefs theoretically if you're not, subscribing to those beliefs in terms of your actions. And I believe that the actions say it all.
I wonder what your dean of theology grandfather would, how with this pedigree of, and I guess we would be accurate to say there is a pedigree of Christianity in your background.
Absolutely.
So this was never really passed down or forced on you?
Well, this is what I say in my book, that my grandparents said to my dad and his sisters, this is what we believe, this is what you are right now, you're a Christian, Methodist, That being said, we encourage you to read and research, and as informed, intelligent people, ultimately make up your own mind about where you stand in view of religion. That's what my grandparents told my dad.
Hmm.
And so, really, I'm doing exactly what they said, which is investigate, use your intelligence, read, think, experience, and make up your own mind.
Sometimes I dream of a church where we'd sing till my heart seemed to grow wings. It's a great line from, it caught me, from your Africaville Skies song.
Well, thank you. The thing is, that's what I love about music. I mean, I spent a lot of time writing with Michael W. Smith, who's one of the most popular Christian pop songwriter singers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we spent months together, and I wrote a song with him called The Human Spark after 9/11. That was on his album, which was called Healing Rain, and is on my new Intimate CD. So I had no problem, I love working with Michael W. Smith, and he's what you'd call a right-wing Christian,
yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be working with him, and George Bush would be sending him telegrams congratulating, because Michael would be congratulating Bush on waffling on stem cell research, for example. I was there when all this stuff was going on, And rather than get into these arguments about philosophy, about the morality of stem cell research, we chose to come together through the power of music and write a song like The Human Spark, which at the core of The Human Spark is believing in the power of the human spirit.
Yeah. By the way, I'd like to express my condolences to you for the loss of a good mate, Paul Quarrington. That must have been tough.
It still is tough. You know, the same within the same 2 months, we all lost Hayden Neal,
yeah,
the greatest R&B singer ever to come out of Canada. There's been a lot of loss, and again, that comes back to what I said earlier, that we have to find ways to learn and embrace the loss, feel sad, and then try to heal ourselves, move through the loss, hopefully by embracing the creative and humanistic spirit that geniuses like Paul Quarrington and Hayden Neal espouse.
I guess I was remiss at the beginning of this whole thing to say to you, I'm also sorry about the loss of your father, Dan. That is, wow, what a kick in the guts. And obviously still processing this. The book, I Am My Father's Son, A Memoir of Love and Forgiveness, Dan Hill. I think this is one of those books that are actually hard to put down. We hear that too much these days in the world of books. Oh, you know, you couldn't put it down. You could have put... Yeah, good luck putting this book down, folks, is what I'm trying to say. And, of course, his newly released CD, Dan Hill Intimate, as I said off the top, the production quality and the intimacy of this CD is akin to October Road, James Taylor's CD from a few years ago. So well done, mate. Well done.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate you listening and reading my book and record.
And I appreciate your time. It's been an absolute honor to speak with you. You've been a part of so many of our lives for so many years. And happy Father's Day tomorrow.
Thank you, and happy Father's Day to you.
We should have ended there because that was sweet. But how is your son?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. He's about to be a father.
Oh!
So there you go.
Wow.
First time I've told anybody this in the media.
Really?
So I'm going to be a grandfather. He's going to be a father in September, and I couldn't be more excited.
Congratulations, mate.
Thank you.
Congratulations. All right, again, happy Father's Day, Dan.
And to you, too.
Take care, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Dan Hill on the Drew Marshall Show. Again, from my point of view, it's just fascinating to hear what people believe, what they believe, what they don't believe, where they land spiritually or where they don't land. Without an agenda coming out of my mouth. Well, we all know this song. Have a listen to Dan Hill, and we'll be back with more, lots more, coming up on The Drew Marshall Show. Stay with us.
Honestly, they mislead you with a lie. And who am I to judge you? And what
like what you've heard? Listen again online at drewmarshall.ca.
Sometimes when we touch, the honesty is too much, and I have to close my eyes and hide. I want to hold you till I die, till we both break down and cry. I want to hold you till the fear in me subsides. Romance and all the strategy leaves me battling with my pride. But through the insecurity, some tenderness survives. I'm just another writer.
It's hard to find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.